Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So I've just come off of my 2-week solitary retreat. I very much appreciated the time of non-engaging with hardly anybody, actually. And so my mind actually isn't engaging much with wanting to say anything. These opportunities of stepping back and having time for retreat are really very useful. That opportunity to direct the mind towards what in Pali is viveka. Viveka, sort of the solitude, I guess, is a good translation. And the Buddha talks about different kinds of solitude, so the Gaya Viveka, the solitude of the body. So it's the physical solitude, which particularly here in Bayagiri, we're very fortunate. The forest is large. Impingement from the world is extremely minimal, and I think also at this time of year, it's the end of summer, and it's been quite hot, so that there's the forest is not active. There's a real silence and stillness in the forest, whether it's day or night. And there's a few jays flitting around my kuti. It's about as much as the activity there is. A couple deer, a mother and a yearling come pretty much every day, hang out at my kuti. And it was interesting to see them just spending the day. It seemed like they were just laying around conserving energy. So this sense of settled quality of the external conditions, so the real strong sense of Gaya Viveka, this physical solitude, and the Chitta Viveka, which is the solitude of the mind, the Chitta, more in terms of say samadhi, the quality of the mind turning inwards and finding an inner solitude, and Of course, that's you know, with the meditation is very directly concerned with a developing of a basis of citta viveka, this solitude within the mind itself. Upadhi viveka, the third one is the solitude that is from the relinquishing of the basis of existence. So it's more of a freedom from fundamental defilements and the wisdom quality and insight. So that it's not a, say, like a neat progression that you follow sequentially, but it's something that you pay attention to these different qualities of solitude and settled and still aspects of our experience. You know, with the cultivation of citta viveka, that taking up of the meditation object, the cultivation of a continuity of mindfulness and attention. So that there's a sort of an internal anchor that's grounded in awareness. This, and of course, this is something we should be developing all the time, really. But when we having a period of formal practice, it's helpful to develop this continuity, because it's just natural that sometimes we feel energetic or diligent, and other times we don't. But just especially when there's a period of solitude, then that really being able to take on Ajahn Chah's kind of admonition or instruction of you feel like meditating, then you meditate, and you don't feel like meditating, then you meditate. Keeping that continuity, and if you're trying to kind of grade yourself, give yourself points, judge yourself, was this a good meditation? Was it not a good meditation? How good did I do? That in itself is an obstruction. Just the fact of being directing attention to the meditation object, and recognizing, investigating, paying attention to what happens. Because we learn from our experience, and sometimes the experiences aren't what we would want, but we're learning about the way the mind works. We're learning about how hindrances arise, learning about how hindrances are ameliorated, are settled, are undermined, and you would develop skill with that. So that there's a sense of a kind of confidence arising over time, and a sense of that one can has the ability to deal with whatever arises in the mind, because we don't need to. You realize in practice that we don't really need to get what we want all the time. We don't. It doesn't have to follow a pattern of how we've conceived it, which is based on our own biases and desires and attachments anyway. So that being, just really being open and ready to pay attention to what's arising. Is the mind peaceful? Can we be present with that? The mind not peaceful? Can we be present with that? Can we work with it? Can we investigate it? So that's really taking an interest in that process of our experience, and the experience of the mind when it's say when other things are shed, when other external duties are shed, or when we set aside the different responsibilities, perceived necessities, and just try to pay attention to the breath or whatever meditation object one chooses. What happens? How do we sustain attention? How do we enter into that quality of citta viveka, inner solitude, an inner stability, an inner steadiness of mind? So that. This is something that relies on our experience. We build a body of skill and pay attention to how to direct that attention to the relinquishing of what's unwholesome, unskillful. It's like when the Buddha taught the very famous teaching that he gave on Magga Puja and the Ovada Patimokkha. And his teaching, 1,250 arhants, and it's like a summary of the practice, and part of it is just the non-doing of what is unskillful or evil, the doing of what is truly good, and the purification of the mind. This is the path of all the Buddhas. And you think, well, that's easy enough. But just the that relinquishing of of what's actually unwholesome and unskillful. How do we do that? How do we recognize what is actually unskillful? And you know, really, the say like the five hindrances are a good mirror or framework for, especially for meditation. When the mind goes towards sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness, or skeptical doubt, these are fundamental hindrances, blocks that arise. And you know, as we are able to become skilled at setting aside, relinquishing, undermining, seeing clearly the obstacle that arises, there's a quality of happiness, of well-being that arises, and this is something that is important to recognize, is that as we practice the different aspects of the path are things that bring about a sense of well-being. And you know, whether it's just the restraint of the senses, the recollection of virtue, when we've established that sense of conduct that is truly good, there's a sense of happiness that arises from that, when we're able to set aside the hindrances. There's a sense of happiness that arises, like the Buddha giving the images that the Buddha gives of for one who's relinquished the hindrances. The images are ones of being free from debt, being free from getting over an illness, being released from jail or incarceration, arriving at one's destination after a long journey. These are all images that give that connotation of happiness and well-being. So that the paying attention to that the well-being that does arise, because sometimes we can make a lot more struggle for ourselves than is warranted, really. We're oftentimes conditioned by culture, society around us, sometimes that sense of you know, if we're not really struggling and no pain, no gain kind of mentality. We make things more difficult for ourselves than is necessary, and just being attentive and clear, and seeing the benefit of setting aside things like just sensual fantasy and proliferation, irritation and aversions, worry and doubt, dullness and torpor. These are things that actually torment us. So that the relinquishing of them, the setting aside, the directing attention toward what's more skillful, more satisfying, doesn't need to be some heroic struggle or something. It's just incredibly practical. It's just like you've got a choice of eating something that actually satisfies, or eating something that gives you a stomach ache. I mean, it's just actually not much of a choice if one's clear about it. So that sense of paying attention, trusting oneself, encouraging oneself, and recognize all the mind really settles down. It doesn't have to keep running itself in circles. Developing of the investigation around just the Four Noble Truths. This is the basis of insight, the basis of penetration. It's not something that is so distant or far away, or abstruse. It's not some abstruse philosophical concept that we have to get our minds around. It's really paying it, from the very early days of when we first began to get interested in Buddhism. What's the distinctive teaching that the Buddha gives, and it's almost always around the Four Noble Truths. So that these are basics or fundamentals, but the returning to those themes to investigate and not doing it out of a rote or a perfunctory manner, but lifting these themes up for investigation there. And the Buddha was able to give many I'm starting to read the new translation of the Anguttara Nikaya today, and read a sutta that sort of pops up as I'm just saying about the Four Noble Truths, and it's a sutta that I can't remember having come across before. Just this great image that the Buddha gives of shopkeepers, being a shopkeeper that's able, the Buddha giving advice to comparing to if one's a shopkeeper and one has to rely on certain things, and having keen eyes, take responsibility, having a benefactor, and then one can expect that one would be able to accrue and accumulate great wealth. And the Buddha explains that in terms of you know, how to, using the, and it's interesting also because I'm sure the Buddha didn't learn how to be a shopkeeper in the palace, but he's so attentive to the world around him, and just able to speak to these different experiences, either his own or of others around, just by paying attention, observing. And the Buddha talking about how for a shopkeeper to get along, but then he takes that to, well, what is a, you know, if a practitioner wants to kind of accumulate and accrue say great amounts of what is wholesome and truly good. And he says it's the same thing. You have to have keen eyes, have to have, take responsibility, have to have a good benefactor. And then he explains what that means. So that the keen eyes is having the being able to observe the this is dukkha, this is suffering, this is the cause of suffering, this is the cessation of dukkha, this is the path leading to cessation of suffering. This is these Four Noble Truths, is having these keen eyes that observe and watch, but having a framework to investigate as well. Taking responsibility and being responsible, putting as one practitioner needs to be responsible for putting forth effort, being one who is diligent, is willing to put forth the effort to bring into being what is wholesome and skillful, and to put in the effort to relinquish the unwholesome, the unskillful. Having the benefactor is being willing to draw close to good friends in Dhamma, drawing close to one who can advise and encourage on the path. And these are very practical advice. And you know, I found it interesting that the Buddha, oftentimes the Four Noble Truths is presented as a sort of like the culmination of where one where one ends up, but there, in this set of teachings, it's the Buddha lays it out right at the very beginning. This is the relying on this investigation of the from the framework of, you know, these keen eyes that investigate the Four Noble Truths, so that in our practice, being able to rely on these different factors and bringing the that investigation of wisdom right at the very beginning, having it inform our practice in so many different ways, and of course that's you know, the reason why we even say keep precepts. If one looks at it through the lens of the Four Noble Truths, then it's for the relinquishing. One sees the difficulty, the complications, the suffering that arises through unskillful actions of body and speech. You know, as we develop our meditation, the mind becomes more settled and stable, and a continuity of awareness is able to develop, because we see more clearly, it feels so much better to be collected and clear than it does to be scattered. And on the wisdom level of relinquishing attachments to, particularly around the attachments of self, of this the construct of I, me, and mine, right? that self identity, that identification that we have towards experience and body, the taking the physical body. This is me. This is who I am. This is mine. Our feelings, whether they're pleasant, painful, or neutral, that sense of identification with that experience, perception, memories. Think of this as who I am. Our thoughts, and whether they're wise thoughts or dumb thoughts, whether they're intelligent or unintelligent, whether they're wholesome or unwholesome, it's that identification. This is who I am. This is me, really. Rather than saying this is all it is. That's another thought. This is consciousness. This is feeling. This is perception. This self-identity is such a limited way of existing, and it keeps bringing us back to suffering. It keeps bringing us back to this unsatisfactory edge of experience. And you think, it's just so limited. Think of our choices that we have as human beings. One of the things, Tibetan tradition, one of the phrases that they use and encourage to contemplate is that you have precious human birth, and you realize, we've taken this birth as human beings. We have this opportunity to have a body that actually functions, and this one in particular it's lasted for over 60 years now. It's pretty good. Having the ability to make choices that can be wise, can be skillful. So this is a precious human birth. But there's so many other things that we can do with it as well. We can waste so much time. We can worry and fret or get obsessed about this or that. And you think, It all is sort of revolves around this narrow perspective of this I, me, and mine. An image you think if one has had the opportunity to go someplace, and travel to some sort of exotic place, you fly into Bangkok or Paris or Tokyo or something, some place, and you get there, and then you stay, just go and stay at the sort of the hotel that's right next to the airport, and then you leave again. This is limited, paltry experience. And it's the same I think we've actually had this opportunity to be reborn as human beings. We have the opportunity to do something really special, and we spend our time stuck in revolving around thoughts of I, me, and mine. All our experience is just limited by this self-identity, and doesn't really. So just really seeing that we actually have, much more opportunity than that, much more potential than that, to seeing clearly the limitation. And the inherent unsatisfactoriness of that limited perspective. So that in practice we're really encouraging ourselves in these fundamentals of that relinquishing of the unskillful, of the unwholesome, developing that which is truly good, purification of the mind, sajitta pariyota pananda, freeing the mind, purifying the mind. And this is the path, the teaching of all the Buddhas, recognizing we have this opportunity and making good use of it. So I'll offer that for reflection this evening.
Mm-hmm.